Welcome back to the New Books Network Gender Studies podcast. My name is Taylor Fox-Smith, and today I have the pleasure of sharing my Australian accent with an extraordinary historian, Dr. Liz Connor, author of Skin Deep, Settler Impressions of Aboriginal Women. In an activist application of her scholarly discipline, Skin Deep acknowledges its dual potential to disturb and to incite a reckoning, giving life to Audre Lorde's famous quote that the learning process is something to be incited, like a riot. Using travelogues, cartoon strips, missionary diaries, paintings and lithographs, just to name a few, Dr. Connor's consultation of a vast colonial archive challenges the amnesia in our national record and, accordingly, the racism and misogyny of our cultural imaginary. Recreating the settler colonial imaginary and the tropes and stereotypes it projected in the imperial enterprise of knowledge production about Aboriginal women, Skin Deep exposes the interlocking oppressions of gender and race that manifested in the 18th, 19th and 20th century. From the innocent native belle to the beaten captive bride, the cannibalistic mother to the barefooted domestic worker, the sexualized metonym of the virginal land to the unsightly malevolent matriarch, the Aboriginal woman was reduced by the settler to a canvas, recklessly painted with the ideologies, expectations and ambitions of the empire, making the Aboriginal woman devastatingly skin deep. Liz Connor, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast.
It's a pleasure. Hi, Zoe.
So, if you could first of all introduce us to your scholarly journey and the way that it led to you writing Skin Deep.
Oh, well, as it is for many people, it was a complete accident. Well, I think you have to follow your interests. And I actually came out of film theory and visual culture and always was, a visual historian and had worked with cartoons before and realised that my archive was really print and decided that I should actually sort of formalise that. So this book I wrote more self-consciously as a print historian. I did film studies. I was led into it through women's studies, so I was always writing as a feminist cultural historian. And so I realised in writing the PhD, where there's a chapter on, the anomaly of Aboriginal women in modern or in modernity or in representations of the modern girl, and realised that not a lot of work had been done around, well, in fact, there wasn't really a complete survey of representations of Aboriginal women. So that's what I wanted to do with this book. And I had the support of an ARC discovery, which was indispensable. And then it took a long time because I had little girls.
Well, I suppose we'll just jump straight into the book then and start with the first chapter. And one of the things that really struck me throughout the book, but something that you really platform off from the first chapter, is a meticulous use of the historical archive. And reviews of the book rave about the use of the historical archive. But what this does is it represents the imperial project as not only this material pillaging of the native custodians of Australia, but also one of destruction through knowledge production, particularly as in the way that the colonizer conceptualized the colonized. And your book unravels this process with a really fascinating term called cultural captioning, and the way that the white settlers executed this cultural captioning, not only through derogatory names, but also through larger tropes and stereotypes. So it was kind of this process of not only naming, but representing. And one of the earliest of these was the native belle as a counterpart to the masculine noble savage. And I'm wondering if, with all that in mind, if you could kind of give us a bit of an insight into those early interactions and how that native belle trope came about, where was its origin story, particularly as it applies to early conceptions of Aboriginal womanhood?
Well, these sort of types and tropes are flying around the globe, really, from the exploratory voyages to the Americas. So, you know, the idea that, America was this virginal land and sort of sexually accessible and ripe for ripe for exploitation was very clear in imagery associated with the very first voyages. And the images that came out of Thomas de Brie's, sort of 15th century engravings. So that was kind of an inceptional moment. And the native bell, or the idea that part of the spoils of colonialism and expansion and incursion was unfettered sexual access to a type of womanhood that was open-thighed and so promiscuous and so outside of European mores that she was, that men would have unfettered access to her. And this was a kind of fantasy. It's present in the Mutiny of the Bounty. In fact, there were much more complex systems of exchange and prostitution and a whole bunch of things going on. But the native bell, I guess what I mean by cultural captioning is that by the time we had the explorative voyages to Australia and the incursion of the First Fleet, the conventions in imagery are so well established that they sort of come to our shores ready-made, if you like. And as soon as we kind of see the sort of standing naked or semi-dressed figure of the young woman, pre-maternal usually, it invokes all of those established conventions that have been going, circulating around the globe for centuries. So quite a lot of it's ready-made, I guess, is what I mean by cultural captioning. I'm talking about the conventions and the imagery that means that a caption isn't really necessary anymore. We have the native bell, we have the primitive woman who's profligate and licentious, and that there are these essential traits associated with her and her body and her sexuality, and they're well entrenched by the time we have, settlement or invasion in Australia.
I would like to expand on that just a little bit further as well. In that chapter, you also mentioned the role of London's print media in taking these pre-made tropes, if you like, and applying them to Australia, but also then expanding that application by widespread understandings of Aboriginal women through these tropes. So in terms of how you went for a historical archive or knew where to look and then found new places to look, I'm wondering if you could expand on that print culture. Like, how was it that these tropes were applied in the Australian context?
Well, I guess the thing to know about is about print culture through this era from, incursion through to, say, Federation, or really the book looks at incursion through to the 67 referendum. So I guess the thing to keep in mind at all times when you're kind of ploughing through this archive is the way it changed dramatically over this time. So the coincidence of colonialism and industrialized print. So I guess really what I wanted to say was, these very early industrialized mechanized forms. So we have particularly print and the loom is the other thing, and travel. And when you think about sheep and the massive expansion into Victoria of wool that then fed the mills, so there's that, and then they're all steam, and then we have steam travel, and then we have print and the steam press. Then we see just a massive kind of shift in meanings and patterns of meanings of Aboriginality being circulated through these technologies. So it's more than just a coincidence. We're actually now talking about enabling technologies of colonialism. I mean, they're really foundational and, causal to the impetus, the hopes and dreams of settlers, particularly with sheep and wool. The expansion is indelibly imprinted or wove into these technologies. So STEAM is critically important. And, of course, you know, something we have to reflect on today is that STEAM is coal, basically. And so, really, colonialism is coal-onialism. And it's critically important given the kind of associated destruction of Indigenous homes that's still going on, to see that continuity of coal through those technologies, those enabling technologies of colonialism, but more elementally as part of the the very means by which people were able to get here en masse. And that's the other thing about STEAM, I'll just quickly say, is it's not as if people weren't, you know, travelling around. It's not as if people weren't reproducing or copying or making copies in terms of print. It's not as though people weren't weaving. All of these things were happening prior to industrialization. But what you have with STEAM is just the sheer mass of it. And that's what becomes important, because the argument of the book is about reiteration. So it's a kind of critical mass of repetition that entrenches meaning until it becomes unquestioned truth.
I think two key words coming out of that will apply to this next question when we talk about chapters 2 and 3 are enabling and repetition. So I'll start with the enabling point. So chapters 2 and 3 really looked at the way that these tropes enabled the colonizer imaginary to justify their agenda. And there's this really interesting point that you make about how they serve to almost abdicate the responsibility of the colonizer in a process that inverts the colonial cause and effect, such that the Aboriginal woman became the cause of her own demise, as opposed to what we now know to be true, which was the colonial project being as destructive as it was. And chapters 2 and 3 bring to the fore two tropes, so the bride capture trope and the infanticide trope. And the infanticide trope, funnily enough, plays into your point here about repetition, in that the print media and various other forms of media that were enabled by this project repeated a fabricated story, if you like, a colonial fake news.
So, that's what it was. Look how far back it goes. Trump would have loved it.
Exactly. So
he would have tweeted it.
So I think that what I would love to firstly ask is about the capture bride trope and the way that you talk about the settler gallantry ideology. I suppose I'll leave it there and get you to elaborate on both the trope and the settler gallantry ideology and how that played into that chapter for you.
Okay, so, all right, well, then let's start with chapter 2 and the bride capture trope. And so in terms of inverting the causality of colonialism, what we have with bride capture trope is really not just, it's not just about women being, Aboriginal women being brutalised by their overlords, but actually something else is being said about Aboriginal masculinity and the kind of lack of governance in the property of Aboriginal men, namely women, which was then extrapolated to their property over land. And so this becomes a kind of a way to think of a kind of Aboriginal man as already dispossessed, because he actually didn't own anything. And what he did own was taken ad hoc. It was never formalised through marriage rights. This was just a brutal impulse of the horde, acting, you know, on a kind of a not so much libidinal, because Aboriginal men, unlike, you know, African slaves, you know, weren't, you know, hypersexualised, because they were, their kind of lack of virility was part of the cul-de-sac of race destiny for Aboriginal people, that they weren't procreating. So it's not so much about sex, really, as just so much the kind of impulse to bash women over the head and drag them off by the hair. So, you know, you might then get that there were frightful screams, but there isn't a sort of detailing around rape in the same way as there might be with the kind of ideology of the African slave and his assaults on white women. Anyway, so that's the kind of – that does establish a kind of justification for incursion, because merely by being in these places where these things were happening, they tended to desist purely by the presence of gentlemen in the bush and the example that they set, meant that practices like, you know, bride capture, for which there's no proof, and infanticidal cannibalism, for which there's no proof, were able to, you know, take hold and just and go and repeat without being ever challenged. And that's how we really see an entrenchment of meaning that becomes unquestioned truth. So then we move on to infanticidal cannibalism, this extremely pernicious trope of the Aboriginal mother as cannibalistic of their newborns, basically, as eating their newborns. And what we see here is, again, a kind of alibi for the massive child mortality that's sweeping sweeping the frontier and the frontier's aftermath through disease, and particularly it seems syphilis, but a whole bunch of other diseases too, whooping cough, measles. And we see this inversion of causality, as you say, which is really Marguerite Steffen's term when she talks about in her study of infanticide. She sees exactly this kind of what I call an alibi around incursion or invasion or the frontier, the massive loss of life, you know, something like two-thirds over a generation in most sort of frontier scenarios. And that this is partly to do with Aboriginal maternity, which is insufficiently fecund, which is a cul-de-sac in terms of race destiny, that fails to reproduce the rising generation, and therefore is part of the extinguishment of, or the, you know, the kind of the dying race theory, the kind of natural extinguishment where the primitive race just kind of withers and melts and disappears once they've so much as laid eyes on the superior white European. So there's a lot going on in those tropes, and it serves a lot of different kind of ends, really.
So I think before we move on to chapter four, I've made here a note that what came across to me was this idea that male observers, the male settler imaginary, played a role in constructing womanhood and femininity by reflecting their own masculinity upon it. So kind of in the iterations of imperial domination, the process of knowledge production continually reverted back to the hegemonic masculinity of the settler observer. And one of the lenses which they used to look at these women was also the lens of domesticity. So a traditional realm of womanhood in the Western European ideal. And chapter four deals with this realm of domesticity. So after looking at chapter two and three, it becomes apparent that the settler imaginary is constructing Aboriginal womanhood through familiar frames of reference. So the captive bride trope plays into this understanding of the woman as wife, and then the infanticide trope plays into this understanding of the maternal instincts of the woman, the role of the mother. And in chapter four, we get into this really interesting realm of domesticity and the way that Aboriginal womanhood not only penetrated that realm, which was the quintessential place of the European woman settler in Australia, but also the way in which that particular penetration of that realm was understood in imagery and in textual reference by the foot of the Aboriginal woman and the creation of this caricature. And I'm wondering if you could explain for us not only the implications of that caricature, but the symbolism and what we can read into that in terms of how Aboriginal womanhood was constructed on the homestead.
Well, quite a bit of work has been done on Aboriginal domestic workers, particularly by historian Victoria Haskins, and she has already looked at the threshold, as actually has Fiona Paisley. The threshold is a really important cross-cultural realm of interaction, and I was mindful of that as I was looking at, you know, one of the key organising frameworks for by which women were, perceived in Europe. And you're quite right, we talked about sexuality, so marriage, maternity, and then domesticity, and of course the other ones are appearance. So with domesticity, I thought these were really important insights of Victoria's and Fiona's and other historians, and they were in my thinking as I was looking through a series of cartoons that I actually had sourced when I was researching my PhD, looking through 1920s newspapers and magazines. And I just noticed that the feet of Aboriginal women were always represented as outsized, as splayed, as unable to be, you know, shod almost. There's a sort of something being said there about something untamable about Aboriginal women, despite them, performing, the critical labour around the homestead and mm-hmm. indeed in white urban homes. And it is indeed, I think I end up talking about Aboriginal women's comportment, and it contrasts with the idea of the native belle and her grace. And you see that reiterated quite a bit, that Aboriginal women are actually, and men, well, men had particular bearing when they stood. You know, you could hang a plum line from between their shoulders and it would hit the ground. They stood so straight, they were so erect, and they had such proud bearing. Something was said about Aboriginal women a lot was their comportment, and that they had a particular grace to their movements. And so around the home, once there's these demands on sartorial codes and the Mother Hubbard print dress on the homestead, and this is really the stereotype, something gets lost there with this notion of an authentic native women's comportment that's unusually graceful, and instead it gets replaced by these outsized, very ungraceful feet. And thinking also at this time, around the 1920s, when these cartoons were really at their height in newspapers like Beckett's Budget and Smith's Weekly and The Bulletin, by cartoonists like Hugh McLean and Ian Gill and B.E. Mins. But something is being said there, I think, about something that's unassimilable to modernity, to domesticity, something that's unsightly. And it's at the very time in the 1920s, in the interwar period, when women, white women, are wearing very close-toed shoes, mm-hmm. so much so there was a big boom in the corn pad market, you see. You see white women's shoes being advertised, and right alongside is an ad for corn pads. So something very interesting is happening with women's feet at this time. And I do think that you know, if you want to think about it in a bigger context, then there's the bigger, you know, the increase of women's presence and visibility, particularly middle-class women's presence and visibility in the city, and the whole kind of typology that goes on there around the city girl, the business girl, the flapper. And then you put that against, what's being said about Aboriginal women and their comportment, and that is that they're really sitting on their feet, they're sitting in history, they're not going anywhere, and they're crossing these thresholds with feet that are almost an encumbrance rather than anything else, and with feet that can only be thought of as, you know, as they're, because they're unshod, they're bare, bringing dirt into the home. It's a very, very nasty trope, and it is repeated again and again in these cartoons.
I think the comment you made before about the shoes that white women were wearing is there's this quite poignant image you have in the book, which I'll try and explain for listeners, where we're situated in a kitchen, and I can't remember if it's a photograph or a cartoon. And woman is in the kitchen with these beautiful stiletto shoes, and juxtaposed to an Aboriginal woman who looks as though she works in the home with the European woman, whose bare feet are placed on the ground. And there almost seemed to be this message of the connection between the Aboriginal woman and the land. Like, there seemed to be a dialogue about the imposition of the white woman on the land through this medium of the shoe, almost separating her from the land, whereas the Aboriginal woman had this intimacy with the ground that was quite a poignant juxtaposition between the two of them.
Yeah, well, I think that's a very interesting and very creative reading, Taylor, that we might do now. But I think potentially something, you know, and something unwittingly is being sort of expressed in that particular photograph. The white woman is in these, as you describe, these white sky-high stilettos. Her hair's sort of wrapped in a sort of a, you know, interwar turban kind of do, and standing off almost in the dark, in the, you know, in the back of the image, are two women in Mother Hubbard frocks and bare feet, and they're holding tea towels, and they look like they're very similar looking girls. They look like they might even be twins. And I wonder if what's, you know, not intended, but sort of what's assumed is going on there is a kind of mastery. I mean, it's a beaten earth floor. So, you know, there's another very similar image of Elsa Chavelle standing with a land woman, what's the expression, a landlady in Copenhagen, Cooper Beattie.
Yes.
And they're standing on the threshold, and they're wearing these very ridiculous sandals, and they're standing literally in rubble. They're standing on the, you know, on the kind of broken ground that's very, very rough, and they really wear hiking boots. And there they are, and this particular woman had gone to extraordinary lengths to maintain a certain domestic respectability, and that has to be conveyed not only in dress but in the you know, the organisation of the home and the cleanliness and the ornamentation and all of those things. I mean, a certain white womanhood is being performed that we have to just for a moment consider might have been quite hard to pull off. But nevertheless, it rested, we have to then say, it rested on the labour mostly of Aboriginal women who were unpaid, whose wages are still being claimed. And while they're doing, you know, the lion's share of the really hard labour, and as Anne McGrath has shown in her study, Born Among the Cattle, Aboriginal women were sinking, you know, lamp fence posts, they were digging roads, they were doing more than just, you know, polishing the silver. So while they're doing the hard yards, maybe something is being said there, Taylor, about the manual labour that they're doing. And that was acknowledged, I think, by Bleakley, or one of the protectors up, you know, in the northern states, was saying, you know, there couldn't be any white women living in the north or in these areas because the heat's just too bad. And the, you know, the presence of white women entirely depends on the labour of the lubras.
Well, please keep going.
Oh, well, just quickly to finish, while all that's going on, these cartoons are coming out, which are pretty ungracious when you consider that these women aren't even being paid for doing the lion's share of settling, you know, of white people's settlement in the areas.
I think that point there about the hard yards that were put in by Aboriginal women, assumedly against their will, and that isn't a centralising generalisation on my behalf, but that labour that went in to creating the frontier of Australia really comes to the fore in Chapter 5, and this almost contradictory exploitation of the Aboriginal woman, but also the protection of the Aboriginal woman as something of Australia, is through this lens of sexuality and the black velvet trope that emerged in this process of eroticizing the other, and how this black velvet trope played out in a public panic about sexual encounters between Japanese pearlers and Aboriginal men. And I think it speaks to a bigger point of the necessity of a gendered lens on colonial conquest of the land and the way in which the Indigenous woman was both something to be owned and something to be used, and that sexuality in the black velvet trope. I'm wondering if you could talk us through that trope and also that public panic, and why did the Japanese pearlers pose a problem to the national psyche at that point in time?
Yeah, well, I mean, we're very close up against actually going to war with the Japanese at around the time of, in 1936, this flurry of print reports that happened mostly out of the Canberra Times. It was perhaps one of Australia's first, you know, full-blown print media panics or scandals around the prostitution of Aboriginal women and girls to black pearlers and fishermen. And I guess the startling thing to consider here is that aside from, you know, pockets of outrage amongst, you know, clergy and missionaries and some humanitarians, there was a widespread disavowal and disregard, you know, and lack of attention to the vulnerability of Aboriginal women and girls on the frontier and in its aftermath. And that's not to say that there weren't, there wasn't, as Anne McGrath has said, a spectrum of relationships, and that there weren't, you know, long-term committed, you know, marriages where they were allowed, but it is to also draw attention to the sexual vulnerability of Aboriginal women and girls. Mm-hmm. And so much so, this disavowal, I'm certainly not discounting the motivation for the protection era was principally directed at the protection of women and girls, so I'm not discounting that either. But part of what happened with the kind of you know, the aphorism black velvet, which was in common use, was that was a way to sort of wink and nudge at this kind of white male imagining of unfettered sexual access to Aboriginal women and girls, partly because they were, they liked to imagine being prostituted by their men wholesale, and the other thing was that they were, you know, they were primitive, and therefore they were more licentious and libidinized. So those were the imaginings going on. So after 130 years of this, we have this, you know, massive kind of thunderbolt print panic around the prostitution of Aboriginal women and girls to the Japanese. And I guess the point I wanted to make was looking at terminology like black velvet and being more precise about it, because it doesn't occur in any of the discussion that goes on around Japanese men having sexual relations with Aboriginal women, and across that spectrum, that also is certainly the case as well, from, you know, from prostitution through to long-term, you know, committed relationships and children and so on. So, so this term doesn't appear, and as it transpires, and I think it's important to note, black velvet was specifically not just about, you know, an imagining of black skin or the genital interior of Aboriginal women and the sort of white male fantasies about that. I'm sorry about the building noise. There's building going on. you have to bear with me.
That's all right.
But what's very specifically being said when you look at where and when it was used is a kind of a racial exclusion going on with that term, and that is that black velvet was actually about white men's imagination of Aboriginal women, and it didn't apply to brown men, because there was a really big kind of disavowal, and even bigger disavowal about brown men or Asian men or yellow men having sexual relationships with Aboriginal women. Suddenly, after 130 years of various initiatives, but widespread, disavowal and apathy, mm-hmm. suddenly, within weeks of this kind of exposure from a story that one of the reporters did with Father Gezel on one of the Northern Islands, bang, it really sort of took off, and within weeks shots were being fired over the bows of Japanese pearlers. I think a crew was detained in Sydney, and this is around the time of the Caledon Bay, violence that was going on there, and the anthropologist up in the north there leading a concerted campaign to put down, proposals for an indiscriminate kind of assault on the Aboriginal people in the area. Mm-hmm. Dispersion. They were still being called, and this particular anthropologist got involved in that. So there was a lot of things going on in this particular moment, and it's just very interesting to see how Aboriginal women's sexuality gets kind of considered or expressed or fantasized about in relation to white men as distinct from black men. Mm. I think that's what I was trying to do there, yeah.
Well, I think that as we move then from chapter 5 to chapter 6, it becomes quite clear to the reader that this book is moving through somewhat of a life cycle, and that life cycle intersects with so many different issues that Australia in its nation building faces in that foundational relationship between the settler and the traditional custodians of the land. And so we've looked at the Aboriginal woman through the eyes of the settler in familiar frames such as the bride, the mother, the homemaker, the matriarch. And in this final chapter, we look at the way that elderly Aboriginal women were vilified, that they were visually disruptive to the settlers' eyes. And finally, the reader is given clarity, devastatingly, that these idealized social positions used as the lenses for understanding Aboriginal women have been disrupted and somewhat hijacked by counter-narratives of prostitution, infanticide, and finally the malevolent, unsightly elderly woman. I'm wondering. Oh yes.
In the sphere of domesticity, the counter-narrative is the fringe dweller, or the incompetent, the incompetent camp lubra. That's the domestic kind of counter-narrative. Mm.
Is that to somewhat imply that the domestic realm is not accessible for the Aboriginal woman, or that they're forever excluded from that realm? Like, could you explain what that term means, the fringe dweller?
Well, I think at that time in the interwar and after-war period, there is a kind of construction, and yes, there's been some good work done on this by Jane Lydon around photography, the notion of the fringe dweller. Mm-hmm. And that is, it does come from actually much earlier in Augustus Earle's images of sort of drunken, squabbling men and women. And that is that, there's a kind of raggedness, there's the precarity and the impoverishment becomes recast as a complete domestic incompetence and drunkenness. Mm-hmm. And that's where the really nastiest kind of vilification of Aboriginal people starts to happen. Yeah.
Right.
So in the sense that you're saying that the book takes those lenses, European lenses, by which women are perceived, bride, homemaker or wife, mother, and then elderly through the life cycle, the counter-narrative for the domestic sphere is really the fringe dweller and the camp lubra. And in those spheres, there's a complete failure, to understand women's economies and women's authority within those economies, and mm-hmm. how law, ceremony were, deeply enmeshed in them. And there's just a complete failure to make any sense of how women may have made, were homemakers themselves and had their had productive economies themselves. So that's a kind of vilification in the domestic realm. And it turns into this this imagery of Aboriginal women as domestic help, indentured servants to white women. And the humour that goes on around their incompetency there, that they wear men's boots, that they clear the table by picking up the carcass of the turkey directly off the plate rather than the plate underneath it. You know, right. all these sort of jokes go on around this notion of their incompetence.
I'm not even sure how to respond to it. It's so emotive. No, in a way that is necessary, I think, that looking at these images and putting them in their historical context and sadly being able to see the lineage to the present day, the way in which these jokes or the satirical or the caricature actually does dip its toes into real life perceptions and the way in which those perceptions impact attitudes at both the individual and the public and governmental public policy level.
Oh, absolutely. And the Northern Territory intervention completely hinged off notions of women's domestic incompetence, women's maternal incompetence, and some quite new ruptures around Aboriginal fathers as paedophiles and their kind of incompetence as well. Incompetence as breadwinners, that goes back a long way, but Aboriginal men as paedophiles, that was a completely new, deployment around the discourse that went on around the Northern Territory intervention, and it's a very, very interesting one. I mean, the stuff around Aboriginal husbands as brutal overlords, there's virtually nothing on that being directed to children. It's purely around their primitive sort of brutal impulses to women, and that's the bride capture trope. There's absolutely zilch around Aboriginal men's mistreatment of children until the Northern Territory intervention, and it's a really particular rupture and a very, very, very effective one. It's as effective as Children Overboard, and it's as cynical and nasty as that as well.
Yeah, and you know, that's interesting as well, the way in which men and women were both attacked, but in different ways, and ways in which the settler imaginary saw were weaknesses for the greater public to, I suppose, justify their own sense of superiority. And I've come across this term of the racial patriarchy in writings of colonial America, where there is the patriarchy functions, and within that there is a racial hierarchy which divides intersectional identities, so the white male followed by the white woman and then the Aboriginal man followed by the Aboriginal woman, if we were to parallel that to an Australian context. And I think that what is just so fantastic about this book is we can somewhat feel removed from it because it feels so far away, and talking about print culture in the day of social media can make it somewhat seem detached from our current context. But the book, and you do make a point of this in both your introduction and conclusion, the book is just as necessary for an analysis of our settler imaginary as it continues today.
Yeah, well, I guess with sharing and liking and linking,
yes,
that kind of capacity to reiterate unchallenged is even more, you know, it's even more lickety split, really, and more effective, you know. Absolutely. Tenfold. Thousandfold, yeah.
Well, Liz, I'm wondering if you can let us know what your next project is. After a book like this, are you continuing on to further analysis of print culture, and what areas of history are you doing research in the future?
Yeah, I'm staying with print culture because prior to radio it was really our public sphere, so it's very, very important, and what we can glean from it's pretty profound. And I suppose that does take us back to the very last chapter, maybe just say a few words about the complete inability to attribute Aboriginal women, as we now can and do, And thanks to the generosity of Aboriginal people sharing their knowledge systems with us, but the complete failure to acknowledge Aboriginal elder women's authority. And so this extraordinarily nasty vilification of Aboriginal women, that just didn't seem to make any sense. I just don't think that white people could see they had any functional reason to be at all. Mm-hmm. So it's really, really the worst kind of racial vilification seems to go on around Aboriginal women elders, and I think that's very descriptive of a disrespect for Aboriginal women, but also a complete inability to acknowledge and credit the authority mm-hmm. That Aboriginal women elders have. So that's interesting. The next project I'm working on is a project called, it's an ARC Future Fellowship, which I feel very, very blessed to have, and it's called Graphic Encounters, mm-hmm. The Inscription of Aboriginality. And I'm going right back to, pre-incursion, pre-exploration representations of Aboriginal people in print media, and I'm trying to look everywhere. Potentially there are imaginings of Aboriginal people in China in the 14th century, who knows? Wow. and I'm looking at, there's three parts of the project, and the one is that what is there what's out there in terms of a print archive of Aboriginal people, so that's engravings, lithographs, mezzotints, aquatints, and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So the first part is what's out there. No one's ever pulled this archive together. The second is where did they go, because they were reprinted. So you might have images from the Bodan expedition that I'm now finding in, you know, a popular fashion gallery in Italy, you know, in Venice in 1845, the same images just go round and round, and when they do, the people's names get dropped off, and wow. That's interesting. Mm. And then the third part of the project is how do these images relate to community now? So how do they relate to descendants, and whether there's, you know, prospects for descendants to look at the images and reflect on them and interpret them with me and inform the analysis that I do, but also whether there's prospects for restitution with copies of these prints.
Wow.
So that's what the Graphic Encounters project is. A lot of people might be aware of print collections, private print collections, or people have all kinds of copies of images of Aboriginal people. And so if they're interested to share, I'm very keen to hear about them.
Excellent. So where can they contact you or even find the project themselves to find out a bit more information beyond this podcast?
Well, it's just in the beginning stages. I need to set up a website. There is a Facebook page for Graphic Encounters.
Excellent.
Yes. And then I guess the next, the obvious thing, I mean, there'll be a conference at the end of next year, a big international conference, and then the project is actually working towards a travelling exhibition.
Cool.
I guess the best thing is to contact me via my email at Latrobe, which is l.connor@latrobe.edu.au. I'd love to hear from you. Lots and lots of families have private print collections, and I'm very keen to get my nose in them.
Excellent. Well, Liz, thank you so much for speaking with us today. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, thank you, Taylor, for your very creative analysis and questions. It's really interesting to hear your take on the book.
Well, it is a phenomenal book. So for everyone out there, there will be a link up on the website for the book. I highly recommend.
Okay, thank you, Taylor.